This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Kevin Field, Director of Academics and Artistic Development, Bentley Music Academy, is here, and we are going to be talking about music through time, and this is the third in the series. We'll be talking about Baroque music. In April, we talked about medieval music, and that was followed by Renaissance music in May. Leading into June, we have Baroque music. Music in the period between 1600 and 1750, from the 17th century to mid-18th century. So to contextualize for all of us, this was the time of Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth died in 1603, so the period starts just before her death. Shakespeare died in 1616. Other notable figures were René Descartes, I Think, Therefore I Am, another philosopher, John Locke. And in the sciences, we have Francis Bacon, Johannes Kepler in astronomy, William Harvey, medicine, who mapped out the human circulatory system. So here we can all hold all those little bits of information in our head.
Absolutely. You've also got Milton and Swift. So you've got Gulliver's Travels being written,
yes.
Paradise Lost as well. And the fact that, the shock horror, the Earth moved around the sun. That's Galileo there. But yeah, Kepler certainly for the discovery of elliptical orbits. And that's the influence as well that becomes a very scientific period of analysis and a very genuine focus on finding form, which is quite interesting given the fact that Baroque is quite a highly decorated form, certainly in music and to some extent interior and exterior decoration within
architecture.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. In fact, the term Baroque came from architecture.
Yes, but it's a term applied to music. It's not applied to music until the 20th century, which is quite interesting. You led in there with the medieval and the Renaissance. They were all modern composers, and we'll discover that later as we get into the 20th century. They're all modern composers. They're all writing new music. So they didn't think, oh, crikey, okay, yes, I'm a Baroque, so therefore I must write like this. So, yes, a lot of filigree, a lot of detail, but wrapped up in quite a strict order of form and structure.
You know, Kevin, you just said something which is kind of rattled my head a bit. You said the term Baroque music wasn't used until the 20th century. So, of course, when they were composing music, they did not say, we are Baroque. Mm. Did they have a term for Renaissance music and medieval music? Did they use those terms then, during the Baroque period?
I do think the same applies. We will look back on the period now of the composers writing, currently the contemporary composers. In 50 years, 100 years, they will assign a period to this. They don't know what it is, right? We don't know what it is right now. I don't think they would know.
But when did all this categorization take place?
I would know exactly when all these periods came about. They are given to us academically. They're just given to us in that sense, afforded to us with an influence from various art forms, collated. And eventually someone will come up with a title for the music of today, whether it just be contemporary, because obviously Bach, Corelli, etc.
They were contemporary
composers at the time.
So, well, at least the term, based on my research, is that it comes from this Italian word, barocco, which means bizarre.
Bizarre. And there's another term out there, which is a distorted pearl or something, or an ugly pearl. Portuguese, I think, influence in that sense. So it's not a pleasant term to describe a music which is absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Why call this period Baroque?
Again, it's to do with the sheer detail in that sense of the filigree of the details. So we're talking about the da capo aria. So someone would sing a certain phrase and then go back and embellish. We've talked about this before, the sort of Celine Dion element of decoration of a simple phrase. At some points, you're playing something a certain way and it is fairly straightforward, fairly simple. And then, because these composers of the day, they were great improvisers. They were better at improvising than the so-called classical musicians of today, something that the jazz people of today would recognize what it is that they were doing. So a lot of detail just came out almost as a matter of spontaneity. I mean, you look at the concerti of Mozart that we'll look at in the next section of classical music, he was improvising. There's not one performance that stayed the same, even though it might have been concerto number something or other. They were different every time he performed. And this was happening here. This was happening in the Baroque period. Improvisation.
Does that mean that today when we play these improvised pieces, which have now been codified in scores, that we don't improvise anymore?
We don't, unless you are to some extent involved in one of those, in inverted commas, authentic or period performance ensembles. And they would be very skilled and adept at looking at and working with something that's called the thorough bass or the basso continuo, which is a figured bass, which is one bass line which then has the numbers of the notes to be played above that one bass line. So you get 6-3, 6-4, 7-5. So these little numbers are the bass. A harpsichord player, especially, or lutist, would be able to improvise a chord sequence based on that note and those figures. And again, you could play it at one concert and it would sound a certain way. You could play it at another concert with a different person playing and directing, and it might just sound a little bit different. So you're not getting something which is absolutely locked into text as we have now. In fact, when you look at the text that we have now, when we're looking back in time, the text that we have is devoid of a lot of information, especially in terms of dynamics, for example, or articulation, because the musicians of the day, they just knew they were steeped in that tradition. Because we have become less steeped in that tradition, we now have more information added on, especially in terms of Baroque classical. They've edited to some extent what it is that the musicians of the day spontaneously knew already. So we've added that visually to the text that we're working with. And then the problem therein lies that we become interpreters. That dreaded word, interpretation, I hate it, in terms of music, because it suggests ego to some extent. Now, you take that material, integrate it into your being, integrate it within your research, and study it, and come up with the best performance that you can of the day relative to the time in which you are performing.
When you say the articulation are now written into the scores, you are talking about when to crescendo, when to...
Absolutely.
Get loud, when to get softer, diminuendo.
Yeah, or length of notes. That's right.
Even the length of notes.
Yes. If you have the time, that is, you can spend a long time discussing how long is a short note. Exactly. And so crescendi that we've added and decrescendi that we may have added in time and also in modern music, they just weren't there. And in fact, with Baroque music, the dynamics were terraced. And that has something to do with the mood, the affections to some extent, that Baroque music was piano or forte.
And it piano was, is soft.
Piano is soft. Piano is soft. So that's why the piano is actually called the piano forte.
Because it goes soft and loud.
Yes, yes. So in the Baroque music, we would just have a P or an F, piano or forte, soft or loud, vice versa. And it would be chunks, big, solid chunks of dynamics within a certain period. And then it would change and offer extreme contrast in that sense. The detail inside of that is very important. So you've got the filigree, you've got the curlicues and the gold leaf, if you like, of that day written into the music, wrapped up in quite a strict form, and then supported by very, very obvious delineations of dynamic. And that's quite interesting when you compare that to architecture, because if you were to take the standard visual bird's eye view, the bigger picture, if you like, of Versailles, you can see this amazing symmetrical building and the gardens and the way that is all laid out. That is the human nature there in that period of formalizing everything,
uh-huh.
Getting everything absolutely ship-shaped and square and balanced. And yet inside, for some people, that's quite grotesque, the detail inside that, you know.
When you say the curly cues, what you're talking about, in a sense, is the busyness of the form.
Yes. Yeah, and the detail of a certain line. We're talking with Baroque music, as Baroque music is the other key time where the orchestra was formed, opera was formed, and we also tempered pitch. You've got to be very careful how you say that, how you tempered pitch, in a sense that we were also getting to a point where we were working at a certain frequency. Everybody eventually gets into a place where we were working with a unified frequency. So we have the birth of the orchestra, we have the birth of opera, and we have tonality. This is a key point as well. We have moved away from the sort of the modal elements that we had
during the Renaissance.
Yes, absolutely. We are now moving to a sense of key. There is a home key. That is the tonic in that sense. There is a relationship. There is a hierarchy being developed. And that also aids form and structure.
When we talked earlier last month about Renaissance music. We said it was the period of humanism. That word humanism would suggest that in a sense that the church somehow lost some power.
Yes, and with Baroque, we're back to...
That's what
we
I'm
are
trying
back.
To say.
We it are is, back.
And some would say that the church became the sponsor of music now, and the music became ornate, partly because when we talk about the church, we are talking about the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And it was during the Renaissance period when Martin Luther started this protest, and we have the Protestant movement. The whole protest also hinged on the fact that the Catholic rituals were very ornate and that Protestantism wanted something more simplified and purer. Mm. And to that extent, we do hear music from the Renaissance period as being a little bit cleaner, simpler.
Right.
Now we've gone back to the church dominating again and being the chief sponsor of music. Mm. Therefore, we have music that in a way reflected the church and how the church is.
Yes,
or was.
We're going back to the censorship. We're going back to conveying a message, a controlled message in that sense, and to get it across to what is probably an illiterate audience, congregation in that sense. That would be interesting to look at the message, the content of that message. That's certainly in terms of the vocal line, in terms of delivery of a message through song. Yes, church absolutely is there, but also court. The court itself, the aristocracy, had a major part to play in this. The musicians themselves, the regular everyday musicians, were sort of like the civil service. They would go to a court if they were lucky. They would be part of a court in Germany, for example, had states everywhere in that sense. And there was a nobleman over here and a nobleman over there. And they all had their 20, 25 musicians and an in-house composer all writing to sort of say, let's show off. I've paid you this money. Write some music to show how good I am. Yes, you have the church and doing what it is that they will and the message that they want to carry. But you've also got an almost secular development of music through the aristocracy and the sponsorship of high art in that sense.
We need to jump into talking about this music, which we say is very ornate, very busy, and we perhaps need to kind of play some to understand what this busyness is all about. I'm speaking with Kevin Field, and we are talking about Baroque music, the period of music that follows Renaissance. Coming up, we'll look at some of the key composers, the kind of music that they have composed, and the music that we continue to hear. This is Front Row in the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. You're tuned to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, speaking with Kevin Field, the Director of Academic and Artistic Development, Bentley Music Academy. We are talking Baroque music. And as we've said
And you
earlier,
say Baroque, you say Baroque. I mean, I'm sure that's correct as well. But I've, I say pantomime. I know a lot of people that say pantomime. But, because we had that little joke at the end of the last show, Baroque and Roll. I know you looked at me and said, is it Baroque or Baroque? But I think, yes, a lot of people would go with the Baroque way.
Can you name me some of these composers during this period?
I can. And some of them sound like the bench for Chelsea Football Club. I just go through a quick list of names. So we've got Vivaldi, Monteverdi, Scarlatti. There are two Scarlattis, Alessandro Domenico Scarlatti. I'm sure he's the fullback. Telemann, Jean-Baptiste Lully, Rameau, Charpentier, Corelli, Albinoni, Couperin, Tartini, Pachelbel, Buxtehude. You're looking, and a lot of those are working out of Italy. You've got a sort of an Italian school to some extent and a German school, and that will affect instrumentation as well, or the design of instruments, and also the cross-influence of the music itself.
Did Italian culture at that time contribute to the busyness? Because, when we speak of the English with, say, stiff upper lip, Italians, we see the hands moving. That's where all the curly cues are coming from.
Absolutely. And that's why they love the tenor. They love the tenor aria. And that's where, that became, of its day, the Malaysian-American idol of its time. We developed a format within opera itself to have the aria become the show-off element for these emerging rock stars of the day.
And talking about opera, that's when opera started. Did they start with original compositions of the opera, original stories?
They would research, going back in time, we're going back to the Romans and the Greeks again, and taking those messages and that sort of rhetoric and message, they'd be dealing with those kind of subjects and putting, yes, then original music to it. Having said that, Handel was quite the one for recycling music. And that's to bear in mind, these composers were in-house composers to some extent. They were working and writing every day, every weekend, certainly in terms of for someone like Bach, who had to write a cantata for just about every weekend, busy writing. So a certain amount of recycling was happening even at that day.
So the opera started with telling old Greek stories?
Yes, to some extent. I think we played a little bit of Monteverdi, Orfeo, in the last program. He's at the beginning of this period of the Baroque period, again, can be divided into three periods, the early, middle, and late periods, and each one of those about 50 years or so. So he's at the early part of that. When we get to Bach, who's really stretching forms and tonalities to some extent, he's right at the end of that. And to some extent, some people signify the end of the so-called Baroque period associated with the death of J.S. Bach.
His music, equally ornate.
Absolutely, extremely complex. If he were alive today, he would be the Chick Corea of the day, improvising jazz. There's no doubt about that. Absolutely extraordinary.
I guess singing now with soloists, as opposed to the Renaissance, where you don't hear soloists, I suppose.
No, it'd be one voice, but sung by many, or four parts, or the 40-part motet. So you have all of those parts, yes, but very much a unison element to that.
So within the opera that is now being introduced, then you have different kinds of singing. What I'm leading to is, like, what's an aria? An aria is being sung. We also have the recitative, which is being sung.
The recitative is more like a rap. That's more like a spoken, like I could say to you, okay, I could read something to you, or you could give me the travel information or something, and I could read it to you like this, and on the
almost at one tone.
Yes, the Penchala link is really slow today. so that kind of thing. So it is semi-spoken in that sense,
the mass.
Yes. There is an element of that, absolutely. The aria is purely melodic, cantabile. That is a vocal line itself, and that is then becomes the tool, the vehicle for the diva in that sense, and then start to shine. The recitative will move the story forward through almost static text in that sense, with a little bit of harmonic accompaniment, and is, as an accompanist, if you're directing that, can be quite a challenge. You have to really know your ensemble, know the text, know your soloist, and work. A lot of work goes into those 2-3-4 minute recitatives, as they are, with the aria will flow, has a more defined form in that sense.
I guess with the recitative, the root word in English would be recitation.
Yes.
So you're, in a sense, reciting something.
Yes. And getting a message across to get onto that next bit of the story in the opera, which may well be a reflective element in the aria itself. We also have then the chorus. Literally a chorus or a group of singers.
Because of all the singing, the castrato.
Ah, well, it's... yes.
Fascinating stuff.
Well, fascinating. And also, there were castrati still around. And I'm thinking whether they were still around going into the 1900s. I would have to check that for sure. But yes, we would now artificially make that as a falsetto. And I wouldn't ruin your levels on your radio by trying to sing falsetto now or a counter tenor. So yes, you've got the element of Shakespeare where, okay, men were playing females roles, in that sense, yes. Female roles. It was happening in opera because the world of music and music presentation was a male-orientated business, male-focused business. Women were not involved in that sense, as the name implies.
Castrate young boys.
That's
and
right.
To keep their Thank voices into...
High, into the soprano range. Yes, yes.
How long would such a person be able to sing to how old?
Gosh, I would... In terms of the quality of the voice, he would probably be a castrati. Well, obviously, by default, he's castrati for the remainder of his life. But then it comes down to that: how long can that sing. Quality of voice, yes, last? That would be case by case situation. Even when you hear a countertenor sing melodic line that's high, it's quite a spooky sound to hear a male voice that, and because it's so very, very pure and clean. Quite an extraordinary thing.
Was it used in Handel's Messiah?
I would probably say yes. What I know about the Messiah is that the premiere was in Dublin and just down from Guinness was 1759, and the Messiah was about 15, 20 years before that. But I would hazard a guess and say yes.
So singing during this period became quite important, as you suggested, the divas.
Yes.
And on account of the importance of the voice, we also have the castrati singing.
You do, but what's very important here is now you're getting music also written specifically for instruments. You've got an influence on voice, which probably by default is from the church and then through opera. And then there becomes, in this Baroque period, more of a focus on writing for instruments. That influence is coming from the court itself. And the predominant instrument in that sense will be organ, harpsichord. If you're listening to a quick guide, what does a Baroque piece sound like? If you can hear the sound of a harpsichord, if you're familiar with that, or an organ, then pretty, but that's by rule of thumb, that's where roughly where you're in that Baroque period.
Part of Handel's Messiah, you have that very busy singing as much as you have in the pieces that you alluded to played with the harpsichord.
Yes. So you got designated periods of moods. So composers would have pre-subscribed rhythms or keys or speeds that would naturally affect a certain feeling within us. So they were very skilled. They were understanding the effect of the power, the communication. That's certainly something with Baroque music. They understood the power of the affect of music on us as human beings. We've got an element of the Four Seasons here, but also with the Messiah, I think it's the Alleluia chorus that we're playing.
Alleluia, 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 Alleluia.
So through all of that, yes, it's telling our story, of course, but very skilled in all of these pieces, whether it's a concerto form or a sonata piece in that sense, the composer is carefully probably making a subconscious decision about the mood itself and choosing certain speeds and keys and rhythms to affect that change. And in fact, artists, I'm going to try and find that information, artists had a certain rule of thumb as well. There is, it's a doctrine of the affections. It was quite an important thing. So the painters of the time, they had certain poses and certain faces that would represent and convey a message and a mood. The same with the composers. As I said, the keys, certain chords, certain rhythms, certain orchestrations would also have an effect in that sense.
Based on what you're just telling me, that the kind of moods and affectations are all highly dramatic. If it's sad, it's incredibly sad. If it's happy, it's joyous.
Yes.
There's no kind of middle ground where it's just kind of calm.
Is there? Absolutely. No, the piece would stay in that calm, or the piece would stay in that high energetic mode. You're absolutely right. It would not change. The only change would be a sense of, we talked before, the terrace dynamics. Very, very loud, very, very soft. But the energy is still there. there'll be an element of echo or repetition of a certain theme. But you're right, there's no development of the mood itself within. That did not come until the classical composers that are upcoming, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, they started to tweak that element, for want of a better phrase. They could start to, rather than deliver a whole phrase in or a whole movement in a certain mood, they would then cut it down to a phrase, an 8-bar, 4-bar phrase of a mood, and then suddenly change that. That's coming. That's coming in the classical period. But with the Baroque period, one mood, one style, one feeling for the entire movement. Next movement, contrast.
You know, listening to Vivaldi's Four Seasons, I can feel the busyness.
Yes.
And I can also feel the great drama in that music.
That is one of the first cases of programmatic music as well. I mean, you've got the creation, I think, is something to bear in mind as well in terms of description of nature, of telling a story. That's something to bear in mind. I think there are little verses, little prose text at the top of each movement or each suite itself within the Vivaldi. And so that gives an idea of the feeling. It's obviously the titles, you know, the Four Seasons, and then the descriptive nature of each season in that sense. But you can hear dogs barking, you can hear the winds howling, you can hear all of that, you can hear nature. It's just extraordinary. That's why there is so much more music than those four or five pieces that we've selected here. There's so much music. It's getting harder to choose as we go through. You know, these periods of definition are getting shorter, but almost exponentially the choice of music is...
More composers.
Absolutely extraordinary.
Now, when you mention dogs barking, you can hear the wind blowing.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say the music of this period is also, for the most part, louder?
Louder than what went before?
Yes, because some of the instruments, some of the quieter instruments kind of disappeared. Like the violin is, even though the violin is not as loud as any of your brass instruments, your violin is louder than the viol.
Only by virtue of tessitura. What I mean by that is the range. So there is an artificial effect where something is higher pitched, it might sound louder. So actually when we're balancing, this is a very interesting thing in terms of a performance of any period. You have to balance carefully the instruments. So within a performance, you may have a piano right across the board, but a piano for a violin high up in its register above the treble clef is going to be a different piano to a cello or bassoon in the lower register. So you have to be very careful how you balance that. There's an artificial construct there in terms of dynamics or instruments being louder. The instruments themselves, compared to nowadays, obviously through technical advances and machinery, instruments are by default louder. They are louder. But you're talking about string instruments. They're using cat gut. They're using gut strings whatever animal that is. They're using gut for their strings, and that is not as loud as what we are used to now with the wires, the wired strings in that sense. The brass instruments were small bore. So you do have trumpets, you will have timpani, but you're looking at calf heads, you're looking at smaller instruments. Probably the loudest instrument there would, the king of all instruments is the organ. Louder probably means more people to some extent. You're looking at a traverse flute. A flute in those days is interesting because we talk about woodwinds, the modern symphony orchestra, four sections in that orchestra, one of which key is the woodwind section. The flute is in that section. Currently, I mean, today's world is not made of wood. It's a metal
plastic
instrument.
Is that plastic now?
No. It's a metal. Or in some people even, it is a metal. Some people even have gold ones. But you've got a wooden sound. You've got a mellow sound. The instruments of the day produce something brighter to some extent, softer generally. When you are performing, when everything is balanced and everything is very focused, something quite soft can be equally dramatic and equally as strong, if you like, loud. When everything is balanced well.
No, the reason I suggested a plastic flute is because now you can get
you
a saxophone made of plastic,
and trombones as well. Saxophones, clarinets, no flute. And that's to do with cost, of course, because those instruments, certainly for Malaysia, it's piano. Every other house has a piano. And then the next choice will be violin. So getting anybody into the woodwinds or the brass is very, very difficult because of the sheer cost, especially with woodwind instruments. Very expensive. So The plastic instruments gives us a chance to, for the beginner, to get going and maybe change their mind.
Okay, Kevin, I'm going to put this burden on you. The next few minutes,
right.
Summarize what has happened to music that we are now in this period?
We have form and we have key, as in tonality. We're moving away from the modes. We have an increase in music that is written bespoke for instrumentation. Got the terrace dynamics that we've been talking about. You've got a reflection of moods. Sorry, you're about to say something. I can see you. Go.
Yeah, because you mentioned also like the opera. In terms of the forms, we have different forms of music emerging during this period too, right?
We do, and a lot of those are based to some extent geographically. If you think that Bach, based in Germany, he's a master musician with the organ, and one of his second cousin, Nicholas, was an organ builder. So he was developing an advanced technique in that sense. There, you've got the string element coming from Italy. People like Corelli developing and advancing string technique. Bear in mind also that these musicians, they are rock stars of now. They were probably rock stars in the day, but they were also jobbing musicians. They were also teaching.
Just like today.
Yeah, Vivaldi, Corelli, yeah, Bach. They were also getting down and doing some honest work teaching young musicians. Hard work to be a musician.
During this period, you have the emergence of opera.
Yeah.
And then music composed strictly for instrumentation, just instrumental music.
Yeah, we have the beginnings, the foundation, if you like. Baroque music is the key point. It's what we've talked before, the medieval period has cleared the land, you know, making a construct here. We've cleared the land with medieval music, with Renaissance music, we've dug the hole now, and with Baroque, we are now starting to pour in the cement for what is going to be the foundation for all of music today in terms of pitch, tonality, and key. So the music that you are now shuffling on your little player, the root of everything that you're listening to is right here in the Baroque period. The other key, because nothing exists in isolation. Everything is traveling through. There's a blur on these dates in terms of Renaissance and Baroque into classical, et cetera, et cetera. You can point a finger at some of Beethoven and Mozart and say, well, actually, that's romantic. There's a hint there of romantic music to come. You've got here with the instrumental nature of writing the for instruments in a selection of movements called the dance suite, you've now got the very, very, you've got the germs of the symphony to come, the standard four-movement symphony. The root of that is within the dance suite, because of the dance suite, which were not meant for dancing. Again, that's something else. That's something else to come. So the dance suite itself had a four movements, interchangeable styles, interchangeable titles and rhythms and keys and speeds. But essentially, that was a four-movement work that was preceded by an overture or a prelude of some kind. That is the origin of the symphony, of which Haydn to come, the father, the grandpapa of the symphony, 104, Beethoven, 9, Bruckner, however many. Some people say it's 9, some people say it's 18, et cetera, et cetera. So we're right here. We're right in the foundation of the what is so, you know, Western art music canon.
The cement is poured.
The cement is definitely poured. It's so very, very exciting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I've been talking with Kevin Field, Director of Academic and Artistic Development, Bentley Music Academy. We've been talking about Baroque music. And I guess the next time we'll be talking about something even more interesting and more complex, neoclassical or at this
classical stage.
Yeah, you call it classical. It's the neoclassical period when we think in terms of the intellectual history of the West. That's the period of your big guns also, Mozart.
Yes, well, as
Beethoven.
Absolutely. Well, now, this, for me as a performer, the Baroque period that we're talking about is the earliest that I go back as a performer. So, yes, and now it gets, for me, as I say, as a musician, as a practitioner, it gets exciting. The areas that we have been discussing before this, so medieval, Renaissance, the performance of that music is limited to a few specialists who are focusing on those works. So, yes, and there's so much to get in. I mean, we've only touched the tip of the iceberg. I've got so many notes here that I want to pass on. But there we go. That's the way it is.
Well, but if you have any questions out there about music, just write to us at thebiggerpicture@bfm.my and we'll try to answer them. Not so sure that I can see anything, but Kevin definitely will be able to.
We do what we can. We do what we can.
It's always fun to talk about music. I'm not sure how coherent we've been, but we have really tried to give you a sense of the period, the kind of music that came out of it, and what are some of the forms that were born during this period. We'll meet again next month and we'll talk more about music.
And we will talk about sonata form.
This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.